Thank you, Blessing and Jonga. Good evening, Zimbabwe. You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America on Thursday, June 5th, 2014. Thank you for joining us live from Washington. This is Sandra Nyaira.
And I'm Chris Gande.
Here are our top stories this evening.
A former finance minister Tendai Biti calls for a transitional authority to run Zimbabwe, saying ZANU-PF has dismally failed to improve the country's ailing economy.
We think that this government has failed. At the very minimum, there must be an NTTC, a National Transitional Technical Council, that must be concerned with these governance matters that I'm talking about.
The Constitutional Court rules that the Harare Central Police Station holding cells are uninhabitable and violate rights of detainees and directs the state to clean up its act.
The applicant's rights to be protected from inhuman and degrading treatment have been violated in terms of the Constitution. And furthermore, they also their rights not to be discriminated have been violated because of their peculiar human rights violations that they suffered as women. Consequently, the court has ordered that.
And the Confederation of Zimbabwe Industries says a three-day visit to Zimbabwe next week by the European Investment Bank is key in Harare normalizing ties with the West.
A former finance minister Tendai Biti today said Zimbabwe is on the downward slide, raising the need for the country to be placed under a transitional authority with regional bodies like the African Union and the Southern African Development Community facilitating national dialogue. Thomas Chiripasi has more details from Harare.
Addressing a news conference in Harare today, former finance minister and expelled secretary general of the MDCT, Tendai Biti, said ZANU-PF has failed to run the country's economy, resulting in what he described as economic lockdown. What is now needed, according to Biti, is what he called a National Transitional and Technical Council, or NTTC, that will manage the affairs of the country, while regional bodies such as SADC and the AU facilitate dialogue between political parties, civil society, and other concerned Zimbabweans.
We think that this government has failed. At the very minimum, there must be an NTTC, a National Transitional Technical Council, that must be concerned with these governance matters that I'm talking about, the economy, which they don't understand, as a matter of agents.
BT, however, noted he did not believe that ZANU-PF will be interested in the NTTC, a national dialogue, saying the ruling party's preoccupation is nothing other than power. He urged President Robert Mugabe and his party to apologize to Zimbabweans for presiding over an ailing economy, which is now in deflationary mode.
Right now in 2014, we are worse off now than we were during the worst of our crisis, the hyperinflationary era. The difference between hyperinflation and deflation is that in hyperinflation, we are actually all rich, we're all trillionaires. But the problem is there was too much money chasing too few goods, hence inflation, the upward spike of inflation. Now we don't have money. I can assure you, if I search all of you, we will not raise $20. You don't have money. So Zimbabweans are worse off in a deflation and depression. A deflation and depression is worse off than a hyperinflationary period, because a hyperinflationary period donates too much economic activity. The economy is overheated and you fail to control your inflation. There has to be a comprehensive reform agenda.
However, ZANU-PF spokesperson Rugare Gumbo told Studio 7 by phone that the MDCT renewal team should wait for elections in 2018, adding the opposition offshoot is power hungry. Gumbo said his party is working hard to ensure that it delivers on its election promises, adding that Zimbabwe's economy is set for a major boom if the new economic blueprint, the Zimbabwe Agenda for Socio-Economic Transformation, or ZIM-ASSET, is implemented in full. On the issue of inviting SADC and the AU to facilitate national dialogue in Zimbabwe, Gumbo said nothing has happened in the country to warrant the intervention of the two blocs. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
ZANU-PF spokesman Rugare Gumbo says the ruling party's supreme decision-making body, the Politburo, is yet to discuss what hero status to confer on former cabinet minister Dr. Nathan Shamiarira, who died at West End Clinic in Harare last night after a long illness. The veteran politician, journalist and educationist was born in 1929. In 1962, Shamiarira was persuaded by the late Dr. Samuel Parerenyatwa to join ZAPU, which at the time had gone on an all-out strategy to recruit intellectuals. But ZAPU was to be banned in 1962, and though not a senior official of the party, he was chosen to accompany Joshua Nkomo to New York to petition the United Nations. But after a month after returning from New York, Shamiarira joined the breakaway party ZANU on its formation in August 1963.
Shamiarira and ZAPU member James Chikerema later formed Frolizi. The party was widely condemned by both ZANU and ZAPU for being as a Zulu tribal union. Shamiarira went back to ZANU and became the Minister of Foreign Affairs after independence. But in 2006, he torched a storm when he allegedly said he did not regret the atrocities allegedly committed by the 5th Brigade in the Matabeleland region in the early 1980s. Shamiarira retired from active politics in 2010 to focus on writing President Robert Mugabe's memoirs. Studio 7's Blessing Zulu spoke earlier on with ZANU-PF spokesman Rugare Gumbo.
Comrade Shamiarira was a veteran of the nationalist struggle who started his political career in the 1960s as a journalist as well as an editor of the Daily News. He started in America at Princeton and then later joined the liberation struggle. He was one of the first members of Darere Chimurenga in Zambia in 1969. And after losing his post during the 1971 biannual election in Zambia, he went to Tanzania to teach at the University of Dar es Salaam. After that, he joined the struggle in Maputo, and in 1980 he came back to Zimbabwe and joined the government. Minister of Foreign Affairs, then Minister of Information and Telecommunication. He did extremely well in the various ministries that he was assigned to. And we are really concerned about his passing on. He was busy now trying to write his book as well as the memoir of President Mugabe. So I took over as Secretary for Information from him, and he always gave us advice on how to handle the media and also how to continue developing the party strategy and ideology.
Talking about writing those two books, we have talked about this before, Mr. Gumbo, the importance of putting what you went through in writing for future generations. Had he completed those two works, or he was still working on them?
He was still working on them, unfortunately. And it's a shame that he passed on before he completed the writings. But I'm sure we'll find some people who complete the work that he had done.
That was ZANU-PF spokesman Rugare Gumbo speaking with Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from Harare.
Blessing also reached political analyst Pedzisai Ruhanya, director of the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute.
He played his role during the liberation struggle, and he also played his role in the development of journalism in Rhodesia and Zimbabwe, as we know it. You know that in the 50s and 60s, he was also editor of the African Daily, you know, using the media to foster resistance, using the media to foster decolonization, using the media as a platform for opposition politics against the British colonial rule in Southern Africa, that is Zimbabwe, although the media was mainly controlled by the white liberal colonialist, but he used that platform for black intellectuals to write, to critique and to oppose and to have their views heard during that limited time. So definitely Shamiharira played his role. But he also had his own weaknesses, and his major weakness, in my view, is not that he was a member of Flores or Front for the Liberation of Zimbabwe, which was mainly a tribalist group made up of the Zezurus, and it broke away ranks with the ZANU in 1971. His major problem were his outbursts, particularly in 2006, when he rebuked Mugabe and Zhowo for their acknowledgement that the abuses in Matabeleland, the massacres in Matabeleland, were regrettable.
Let's talk about also his legacy, Mr. Ruhanya. Some are saying he did a good thing in stepping down when his health was failing him, as opposed to dying in office, as we've seen with some politicians. What is your take on this?
We cannot celebrate those things. Those are common things. You know, when you are old, you must step aside. The idea that Mugabe is not stepping aside must not be used as a yardstick to praise those who step aside when they are old, when they are beyond the retirement age. Let's talk about substantive things.
And that was political analyst Pedzisai Ruhanya, director of the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute, speaking with Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from Westminster in Britain.
The Constitutional Court today passed a landmark ruling agreeing with the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights that holding cells at the Harare Central Police Station are uninhabitable and degrading, especially to women. The ruling follows a case filed 2 years ago by members of Women of Zimbabwe Arise or WOZA and others following their detention at the police station's holding cells. The women claimed they were exposed to inhuman conditions. The Constitutional Court, as a result, has directed the state to provide, among other things, clean toilets in the cells with toilet paper and a washing bowl, access to clean water to detainees at all times, and most importantly, allow detained women to keep their undergarments, including bras, and wear suitable footwear. Attorney Zimbabwe Chimbwa of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights says his organization hopes the decision of the court will be immediately implemented by the state. We reached out to him earlier on.
Well, the first two things that they did was to make a declaration that the applicant's rights to be protected from inhuman and degrading treatment had been violated in terms of the Constitution. And furthermore, they also their rights not to be discriminated had been violated because of the peculiar human rights violations that they suffered as women. Consequently, the court has ordered that the state do the following things. Firstly, the state must, with immediate effect, allow women who get detained in these police cells to keep their undergarments, including brassieres, and to be able to wear footwear, things which the police did not want before this judgment. Secondly, they've also directed that the state must, with immediate effect, ensure that each and every person detained in police custody overnight is provided with a clean mattress and adequate blankets. The court also directed that the holding cells be structurally changed and provide for a private toilet that can be used, and they must also provide toilet paper as well as a washing bowl to this toilet. And as you can imagine, all these things were not there at Harare Central Police Station. And the court has also directed that the good standard of hygiene should be maintained at these holding cells at all times. And in particular, they must ensure that they provide bathing facilities for all persons detained in custody overnight.
Why people would want to understand, would the police not allow women to keep their undergarments? What was the reasoning behind that?
It's not really clear where that practice came from, but from my experience going down to the police station and speaking to these people, they have this rule that you must have one clothing item on you And I've heard some police officers say that this is in order to protect the detainees against attempting to commit suicide. And I'm not too sure whether that is contained in any practice direction or it's a reason they love throwing around.
That was Attorney Zimbabwe Chimbwa of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights on the line from Harare.
You are listening to Studio 7 for Zimbabwe from the Voice of America in Washington.
Studio 7 can be found on the 4930, 5930 and 15455 kHz shortwave frequencies. We also broadcast on 909 medium wave or AM frequency.
Now we take a look at regional and international news.
Gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants have killed hundreds of civilians in new attacks in northeastern Nigeria. Witnesses say the gunmen attacked at least three villages Monday and Tuesday in the Gwoza area of Borno State, a stronghold for the Islamist radical group.
Leaders from the Group of Seven industrialized economies are in Brussels today for a second day of meetings that have focused on Russia's involvement in the Ukraine crisis.
And the Prime Minister of the Central African Republic is defending his decision to temporarily ban text messaging in a bid to combat spiraling unrest. The Prime Minister says the Central African Republic is at war. You are listening to Studio 7 coming to you live from the Voice of America in Washington.
As reported earlier, the country's constitutional court today handed down a landmark ruling condemning holding cells at the Harare Central Police holding cells. A five-judge panel heard arguments in June 2012 during the constitutional challenge and reserved judgment. The same panel at the time conducted an inspection of the station to ascertain the alleged degrading condition of the cells. For perspective, reporter Tatenda Gumbo spoke with human rights lawyer Lizwe Jamela and Women of Zimbabwe Arise founder Jenny Williams. Williams says the landmark decision is not only for Woza women, but all women in Zimbabwe.
For me, the greatest victory is that we've not only won Makotonga, Selina, and my other colleagues, but Zimbabwean women have won. And those who are finding themselves in police cells will feel that this victory is theirs too.
Mr. Jamela, what kind of precedence will this set when we look at this ruling that was handed down today?
This matter is not only the winning of Woza as an organization, Jenny Williams and the three colleagues, but it's actually something that goes to set a precedent in terms of what treatment should be done to anyone who finds themselves in police cells. Because the law is there, but sometimes it's about attitudes. The law should just be pronounced by our court of law. And if the law is just on paper and not being put into pronouncements by court, sometimes we find that officers, like police officers, sometimes tend to be so complacent and they just don't even give regard to what the law says. Because the law about treating someone with dignity has been there. Treating someone in a humane manner has been there. But the question is, what has been happening in practice?
Ms. Williams, this case came out from your experience along with other women of Woza. Can you explain some of the conditions that you faced at that time and that, of course, might still be faced now?
Yes, but you know, if I live to be 100 years, I don't know if I will ever really manage to find the words that will describe the conditions that we survived under for those days. But it was totally intolerable. Those days that we were then in the cells, there was raw human waste in the actual cells, so much so that the police couldn't put us in the cells, but had to keep us in the corridor where the cells, leading to the cells. And even in that corridor, the sewage was still obviously seen drought on the walls. The smell was still so, I will still smell it today.
Mr. Jamila, as a legal practitioner, where do you stand in regards now when you look at maybe those who face such issues if they are taken in remand? What can they expect and what should they expect from police in regards to this ruling?
Unfortunately, some of these things, in as much as we have a precedent, have been set. Because, to be honest, I can also quote another case that happened earlier before this one, where some cells were actually declared to be, to detain someone in such cells was declared to be unconstitutional. In a case where there was a woman called Mrs. Kachingo and another one for Wellington to be able. The problem we actually have in Zimbabwe is that this case would actually be taken as like as a case which speaks to Harare Central Police cells. But what I would want to advise is to advise authorities to say this should not be the case, like Jenny is indicating, to say where a ruling has been made which actually speaks to conditions of cells in general in terms of our standards in Zimbabwe. I think it's now up to the state to actually up its game and try to make sure that they up the standards, they improve the standards of holding cells. Because when someone is being arrested and they are being detained, the only right that is being tampered with is supposed to be the right to liberty. And all other rights are supposed to be restored.
Ms. Williams, do you think that the police will follow suit with this ruling?
Yes, I think it is up to us as human rights defenders. It's up to all Zimbabwean women. It's up to the people who find themselves in custody to read the Facebook, to read the Twitters that we've been flooding today, and to get the news. And WOZA will do a lot of work to conscientize and raise awareness. But people must defend their rights.
That was Women of Zimbabwe Arise founder Jenny Williams. You also heard from human rights lawyer Lizwe Jamela.
The Confederation of Zimbabwe Industries is hailing the impending three-day visit by the European Investment Bank to Zimbabwe as key in normalizing ties with the West. The EU delegation is expected to meet Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa, the CZI, the Zimbabwe National Chamber of Commerce, Bankers Association, and other business bodies.
But EU Ambassador to Harare Aldo de la Russia has made it clear that the EIB will not do any business with the government of Zimbabwe, as the country owes the bank more than $300 million. De La Russia says the EIB's initial loan to the private sector might be in the region of $50 million, depending with the quality of projects. CZI President Charles Msipa tells Studio 7's Blessing Zulu that the visit next Wednesday by the EU is a follow-up to the visit last year by a Zimbabwean business delegation to European capitals.
What I can tell you is that at the end of January of this year, private sector delegation from Zimbabwe had meetings with officials from the EU, including officials from the European Investment Bank, at which we made the case for greater commercial and economic cooperation between Zimbabwe and the EU, and for removal of restrictive measures that are applied by the EU on Zimbabwe. As part of the commitment by the European Investment Bank, they committed to do a follow-up fact-finding and assessment visit to Zimbabwe. They made the commitment to resume lending to the private sector in Zimbabwe. And I see this visit as a follow-through on the commitment that they made to us at our meeting in January in Brussels. We will be meeting with them, and I think they want to get a better appreciation of what the needs and requirements are for private sector funding in Zimbabwe.
So this is specifically limited to the private sector?
The understanding I got from them was that as the current position is that they are not yet in a position to lend to public sector in Zimbabwe, although they expect and hope that this position will be reviewed later this year.
That was CZI President Charles Msipa speaking with Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from Harare.
An independent Zimbabwean chartered accountants firm says the overall mining income fell by $67 million in the first quarter of 2014 due to volatile prices of minerals worldwide and the country's feared controversial Black Economic Empowerment Program. According to H&E Block & Company, the 15.4% decline in mining income this year compared to the same period last year is worrying as the nation's mineral resources have almost become the mainstay of the economy. A company director, Eric Block, says total income was $435 million compared to $502 million in the same period last year. Block says the output for the quarter included gold production of $134 million compared to $169 million last year.
That decrease was caused by two things. The first has been the drop in the world price of gold. Gold has been falling in value since the middle of last year. As far back as May last year, gold was at $1,700 an ounce. Now it's at approximately $1,260 an ounce. So it's lost about 25% in value. And so that's been the first reason why we've had less mining revenue. And the second reason is that many of the mining companies have been reluctant to pump any more working capital into their mines until there's final clarification over the indigenization program. Because with government talking about now 100% indigenization of the mines, the investors are hesitant to provide extra funding. And so that's also curbing production. And so those really were the two reasons for the decline that we witnessed after 2.5 years of constant growth.
So now, what are the implications here concerning Zimbabwe? Are we going to see any immediate impact of this on the economy?
No, not until there is clarification on the indigenization laws and that they are such that the foreign investors are willing to continue investing.
And that was economist Eric Block speaking with Studio 7 from Bulawayo.
Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa was not reachable for comment as he was not answering his mobile phone. Independent political and economic commentator Vegezela Maduna says corruption is also ravaging the mining sector.
Indian policy almost literally is going to destroy it completely, the mining sector, if it hasn't destroyed it at all. Because everybody's wrong fingers are rushing to the mining sector. If everything was well, Minister Obed Mpofu would have been the last person to be removed from the mining sector. But he was the first of all the ministers. Everybody knew that when cabinet reshuffle comes, he definitely was going to be the first one to go. It tells the story that really there's nothing going on in the mining sector. And there's really not a surprise that the official income in that sector is going down. And it is a cause for concern because really the economy of this country should be built by the mining sector. So it's alarm bells that where we are going is certainly the wrong direction.
And that was political and economic commentator Vegezela Maduna speaking with Studio 7 from Gwanda, Matabeleland North Province.
The Gwanda municipality in Matabeleland South says it is very concerned about the rising number of HIV/AIDS-related deaths in the city and has tasked the administration to research the causes and provide specific age groups of the most affected people. Reporter Sandekile Mhlanga spoke with Gwanda Councillor Justin Majale.
Yeah, we were worried about the alarming rate of HIV-related illnesses and deaths, but apparently the report was just a blanket of those people that were affected by HIV illness or death-related illnesses. And we were saying that maybe next time the department should appraise us with the group that is most affected so that we can see the trend and maybe institute the appropriate education measures.
Was there an indication that there could be one group that is more affected than the other?
Yes, we suspect that maybe our youth has become so vulnerable owing to the socio-economic hardship